What's up, everybody? Welcome to Midrange Magic, the show designed for the competitive casual player. I am your host, Brian David Judkins, and with me, not this week, is Vijay Bangalore is not here. He is too busy out being a rock star this week. He had a really, really nice gig with his band. They're playing at House of Blues. So instead, I have with us again, he's a friend of the show. He's been on a couple of times, and he just came off of it, of an Illinois State victory. Wiley Mock is with us.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
I brought Wiley on the show this week for an important reason, because as I just said, Wiley just you just took down States in Illinois, the TCG States.
I did.
Tournament. And Wiley is a guy, you know, Vijay, we have Vijay on the show, and Vijay's really, really keen on the limited scene, but I wanted to bring somebody on who is really, really knowledgeable about the constructed scene, because Wiley, you play that, I would say, almost exclusively, right? You don't really draft a whole lot. You don't play sealed a ton.
When given the option, I prefer playing constructed. I love playing standard, even everything from standard to modern, even EDH. I prefer using the cards of my choice.
And in your own words, I've heard you mention, you know, I like to build all of the decks. You're a pretty aggressive trader, and not necessarily a trader for profit, but I feel like you're an aggressive trader because you just want to have all the cards so you can kind of build whatever your heart's content.
Exactly. I enjoy playing different decks a lot.
Yeah, so as I said, I brought Wiley on because at least in the community that we play in the shops here in Chicago, he is one of the more knowledgeable guys as far as standard is concerned. And so you won States. You had a top four finish at World Magic Cup qualifiers.
In Chicago.
Here in Chicago.
Yeah.
So obviously Nat and Rue will finish on that. And most importantly, you won game day this Saturday.
Over the illustrious Brian David Judkins.
Oh, that's true. I finished second place in two events, and today I got second place on tiebreakers. I didn't even lose. I just lost on tiebreakers, but you can't get mad at that. So, this episode today we're pretty much focused on standard, and that's because, you know, Pro Tour Theris just came out and really kind of, I think, woke everyone up to the potential of the new set, because we were all kind of, I think everyone after rotation was pretty much lost. Theros was a very confusing set in the sense that it's full of things that demand attention but don't necessarily jive with older mechanics. Would you agree?
Well, I think when you were looking at Ravnica, and the loss of the buddy lands really can't be underestimated. People were just used to being able to jam their three-color decks with the most powerful or most valuable spells out of each color and just kind of mash the deck. You look at a deck from last format like Jund, which didn't have any specific game plan, just had a lot of powerful cards from a lot of different colors and was able to cast all of them very easily. Or even something like Naya or even American, they just jam all the most powerful spells into one deck.
It felt very much like Alara, like we were back in Alara again, because we had the mana to kind of play whatever we wanted, and so we were just trying. And again, you know, Alara block really sort of found that it wasn't necessarily all about two colors the way that original Ravnica had really sort of like figured out how those two color identities go. But then, you know, Alara took it a step further and said, well, you can have these three color identities. And with the mana and with all the gold cards, it was very easy to find those you know, synergies and those neat little decks. But then, you know, what we mentioned last week was we got from Ravnica and then we got to Theros, which is proving to be a very, very interesting set. But I was concerned that maybe it wasn't the best set to bring in right after Ravnica, because it essentially said, hey, you've had a lot of time playing with all these gold cards. But now it seems like, you know, the things that make Theros very, very good are single color connotations. And yes, Devotion falls into that category, but, you know, there's a lot of double mana cost. There's a lot of things that don't really jive for like a very smooth and quick three color deck. Do you feel like that inhibits the way that Constructed is moving? Because usually we see right after rotation that usually the as people are starting to like get in, and because, you know, we still only have one set from Theros, right? We still haven't seen Born of the Gods. We still haven't seen Journey to Nyx. So it is not unreasonable to assume that the previous block which is all fleshed out, and we've got all those resources, that kind of dominates. I mean, Innistrad dominated for 2 years in Constructed. It really kind of took over the format because the creatures were of such quality.
Not just the creatures. I mean, the cards in there were just so powerful.
Yeah.
So those cards, I mean, and whenever you have a standard card that can make a splash in something like Legacy, Modern, and Eternal format, holy cow, I mean, you look at something that you can't mess around with. And I will say that I really want to commend the developers. You know, people at their first couple of weeks of Theros were trying to jam, you know, their aggro decks and stuff that they were, you know, very familiar with from the last set. And you look at the decks that came out of the Pro Tour, and what was there? Devotion, devotion, more devotion. Every color of devotion except white. And, you know, I thought, I said last time I was on the show, I think that Wizards has a duty to create a format that at least, you know, it's not dominated by anyone, but it's one that you can play a lot of different decks, that it's fun, it's versatile, and I will say this, Theros so far has proven to be, you know, obviously slower, but very versatile. You can play a lot of different cards, you can play a lot of different decks. Devotion looks really powerful right now, but there were so many decks. Even from, like, even with the Scars and Innistrad standard, you know, Delver pushed so many decks out of the format.
Yeah.
You even saw a lot of the same things with stuff like, even like Jund or American.
There's just so many well-designed cards that nobody is even considering because one particular strategy is just so dominant that it you know, there's not even really a reason to consider any of these other fun decks. And that also pushes out a lot of the Johnny players, a lot of the people like Sam Black who want to experiment, who want to try and get creative. And it's like every time you stretch outside of the defined meta, you just get run over.
I mean, I was looking. I remember the first time we were looking at the Pro Tour Top 8 list when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
And first list that caught my eye actually wasn't even the Mono Blue list. The Mono Blue list was the list I took in one Illinois States with.
Well, you and I both had the Mono Blue list built even before day two of the Pro Tour, right?
Right,
I mean, I think we both picked up on that really, really quickly and said, hey, this looks like it's got something. Let's put this together.
I mean, this format has pushed, this Theros standard has pushed a lot more emphasis on synergy as opposed to just overall power. Somebody described the Mono Blue deck to me as something as like, you know, 45, 50 cards that you really wanted to play with, and kind of like, you know, 10 to 15 cards you kind of had to play with. And, you know, the first time I looked at this Mono Blue list, I remember thinking to myself, well, some of these creatures are kind of bad, but, and the list I wanted to jam was Mono Black. I mean, my opinion was I wanted to play, I haven't had a chance to play Mono Black in Standard since Necro was a thing, you know, from the late 90s. And I won every chance I could to play Mono Black. But the more I looked at this Mono Blue, it's like, you know, let's try it. And the more I played it, yeah, the creatures are kind of janky, but they work. The deck works well together as a whole. And the more I played it, the more I realized that some of these creatures, they're actually really good. Like a card that we didn't look at all last season, like a card like Night Vale Spectre, is dominating in the mirror against any sort of deck. Just a chance to steal somebody's good spell. Like, I've stolen people's Mizzium Mortars, which they could have used to wipe my board. I stole somebody's Swamp and a Thoughtseize after to strip Supreme Verdict out of their hand. It's really good.
I had an interesting matchup today, actually, where I was able to connect a couple of times against one of these black-white decks with Night Vale Spectre and was able to keep up my land drops because I knew that Cyclonic Rift was really, really good in this particular matchup. And eventually I had the mana and hit a Banisher Priest and was able to Banishing Priest my opponent's Obsidat. Like,
that's gross.
Yeah. And you know what? That's a card that's going in. It's in the mono blue. It's in the black devotion decks. It's now in the green red or the green black sort of control-y deck that's made a little bit of a splash here at Louisville. But my question is sort of going back to this rotation thing. Do you think that this heavy monocolor devotion, do you think that limits deck building, and do you think that that limits our options as far as having to leave so much of Ravnica behind because we are kind of tossing away all of these gold cards? And the hybrid cards from Ravnica aren't necessarily stellar. I mean, the blue ones have turned out to be pretty good. You know, Boris Reckoner is obviously very good. But a lot of the other ones just aren't, they either are hybrid cards that aren't creatures. I feel like, you know, like you said, is we have to use so much of what we really wouldn't care to have to use in order to get that powerful effect, to get the devotion, to get the Master of Waves and the Polykranos activations. And, do you think that limits us as to what our options are to get really creative and fun in the set.
Of course. I mean, you look at a card, look, Nykthos, and that's the deck that's powering, that's the card that's powering all these devotion decks.
Right.
And you get such, I mean, it's a linear effect, but it might as well be exponential. You look at Miyahara's Colossal Gruul deck out of the top eight, and between Nykthos and, I mean, he described it as a combo deck in his tech, and rightfully so. At States, I was just walking through the top tables. I passed by a guy who was playing Mono Green. He had a 20-20 Revenant Hunter. He had probably about 30 permanents in board. He cast a Disciple of Nihilata, gained something like 48 life. He had Polo Kranos with 15 counters on it. Stuff like that is, it's pretty crazy.
I mean, that's pretty fun to do when you talk about Johnny players. And that, you know, that may be where the new Johnny style lies, is you have to maybe get off of the whole, I play three different colors, I get to do all I want, and just start getting crazy with, you know, Nykthos mana and seeing what you can do. I was playing green, you know, somebody who was playing the Miyahara deck, well, a variation of the Miyahara deck today, and I commented that it felt like I was playing Eggs, like the modern Eggs deck, because he would start going off on his turn, and we'd have dice all over the table trying to calculate how much mana he felt. And it was like I was playing a Storm deck. It was like, all right, you've got this much mana, you spend this, then you go up to this much. And then one of the more crushing things that these devotion decks can do to you, especially the green one, is where they activate Nykthos, Shrine to Nyx, get a bajillion pieces of mana, and then they start going off, and then they do all these things, and then you're like, wow, that was a lot of things to do in the turn. And then they go, okay, now from my land drop, I'm going to play another Nykthos out of my hand.
Or the original one.
Yeah, and get rid of the original one, and now I'm just going to do the process all over again. And it makes me, you know, there are a couple of things in that strategy that I want to talk about when we get there. So I do want to go over states, but let's maybe start tackling some of these deck lists, because There have been a couple that have started to stand out. Obviously, some of the devotion decks, but some two color decks. Mm-hmm. Some of these things are really starting to stand out. So I know you've had a chance to play at least three of these in the past, you know, couple weeks since Theros has come out. Where do you want to start?
We can talk about the first deck that I wanted to build as soon as I, you know, Theros came out, was the green red monster deck.
Okay.
So, you know, without...
Because we're seeing... Let's acknowledge this for a second, though, because there is a green-red monsters deck, and this is the deck that you faced in the finals.
Yeah.
Right. So this is a monsters deck that's playing Polukranos. It's playing maybe Ember Swallowers. It's playing...
Stormbreath Dragon.
Maybe a single copy of Arbor Colossus.
Maybe Rurikthar.
Gorklan Rampage. Yeah, sure. Some Rurikthars. So this is pretty much... I'm going to get some early mana dorks, get a little bit ahead on curve, yep, and cast 5 and 6 drops on turn 4 and 5.
Even 4 and 5, you know, 4 drops on turn 3.
Right.
You know, just being able to get your guy, you know, your big dudes out there consistently. And the deck...
I mean, were you surprised at all that this deck came out? I mean, we had, you know, we already saw Domri, who by the end of Ravnica really came into his own. Like, people finally were like, finally, we've got cards that, like, utilize how good this Planeswalker is. And then they spoiled Xenagos, and everyone's like, everyone, there was this giant groan that erupted from the Magic community when they went, dude, you just gave us 2 Gruul Planeswalkers in a deck that's already good. It's like whenever Jund gets more stuff to make it better, it just gets really, really aggravating. So, plus they made Monstrous, which is pretty, not exclusively, but best in a green-red,
you know, like,
scenario.
Like
anyway.
I talked about last time I was on the show, you want to be able to use your mana efficiency. You know,
right.
Those who spend, you know, the most resources will generally
win. I'm surprised
win.
You remember. You were last on this show like 2 or 3 months ago.
You know, good memory. But having these monster creatures with monstrous abilities give you the option, like, oh, I've got 10 extra mana. I got to do something with it. Okay, I'm going to turn my Stormbreath Dragon from a 4-4 into a 7-7. I'm going to Stormseeker you on top of that. Or I'm going to take this Polukranos. I'm going to dump 15 mana into him and wipe your board. I will say the green-red monster list, obviously not as explosive with the mana. It plays mate 1 Nykthos probably at the most. But it's, you know, your classic kind of ramp deck. You know, get a mana dork out there and just start dropping 4 and 5 drops and beat your opponent into submission. If they have answers, they do. If not, well... See you next round.
Right.
I think the deck has many powerful sideboard options against control decks as well. Something as simple as Mistcutter Hydra, Rurikthar. They ruin a control mage's day. These kind of decks, though, the problem that they do run into is, you know, they're prone to running out of gas.
Yeah.
And that's the problem that Domri does fix. But, you know, even on your best day, you might build a green-red monster list with 25, 26, 27 creatures, and giving you, at best, you know, 50-50 drawing creatures with Domri, which still isn't bad. Doesn't make him a bad planeswalker, but he's definitely a build-around. And when you build around that a card like that, you know, sometimes you leave yourself open to other strategies. For instance, the green-red monster list that I played against in the Finals of States, if you think about it, I went under him. I tied up his mana with his mana dorks with Tidebinder mages, and I killed him before he could ever really get going. You know, that was my plan. I was really kind of worried about the match.
But just to be clear, you built a mono blue devotion deck that you won on the stage. So when you say that you went under him, I just wanted everyone to understand like what deck you were playing with. Now, do you think that this version of the deck, because there is the dip, we have the monsters deck, and then we have the Miyahara devotion list, which is very, very different. Well, not very different, but it is kind of running, you know, one is more mana focused and one is more creature focused. Does the green red monsters deck, I feel like that version is a little underpowered right now in the wake of these white and black decks that are starting to peak up. It has so much removal that can really hit anything they've got. It has Banisher Priest, which people are starting to play more and more and more because it's like, you know, just a slightly better Fiend Hunter. Like, where do you feel like this deck is positioned? Because in the first 2 weeks, it seemed really, really good. But I think now that Theros is getting its legs underneath it, this deck seems like it's really, really easy to disrupt.
You know, the problem that you have with most mid-range decks is, even like if you go back a couple seasons and you're like, the primetime decks, the Primeval Titan ramp decks, sometimes you ramp into nothing. Sometimes you draw your ramp spells, you don't draw the threat. Sometimes you spend all your resources powering out a big dude and they have Doomblade, they have Hero's Downfall, they have the Banisher Priest. Whoops, you just invested 3 turns and all your resources into casting one dude, and well, that one dude's gone, and the deck has to have, you know, at least 24 lands to be able to reliably cast your spells, and you start drawing lands, and you run out of gas. I mean, that's what Domri's there to fix, and, you know, I said, even in your best-case scenario, you might be 50-50 to draw a creature. You know, Domri, obviously, in the matchup against a control deck, is your best friend there. But with the rise of all these Esper decks, you know, mid-range decks have traditionally fallen prey to these control decks, and these Esper decks right now, they're packing up. Doomblade was probably one of the best cards that got reprinted for them. And they have all this, you know, pinpoint removal, and they've still got the ability just to cast Supreme Verdict and say, have a nice day. That's something that green-red is extremely vulnerable right now. They don't have access to, you know, creatures that are indestructible, and just sometimes, at some point, they'll run you out of cards, and you're out of threats, and they kill you with an Aetherling, they kill you with an Elspeth, anything, something like that.
And not only that, but, like, even one thing I'm seeing right now that is a product of Theros is that even the aggressive decks with maybe the exclusion of mono red, but even mono red has got Chandra now, is that it seems to be, you know, with the advent of Scry and what's going on now, it's you're seeing these aggressive decks that seemingly don't run out of resources. Like, I can't really remember playing a deck in the past 2 or 3 weeks, even an aggressive deck, that was literally to the point where they just went, well, I dumped my hand, I'm out. Like, it seems like people are still in the game as the game is going on, and that can be a real threat for these mid-range decks that are designed to, you know, kind of shut off that resource valve really quick against those faster decks.
I was really skeptical about Scry. I wasn't playing the game when Scry first came into the game. When they announced they were reprinting all these cards of Scry, I was like, just a little skeptical, especially like Scry 1. Scry 1 doesn't feel very good. You have to get to Scry 2 before I feel like it's got some real power to it. Scry 3 is obviously amazing, but even like these new temples, the Scry 1, if you've got nothing to play on that turn, you take a look at it. Is it a card you need? Is it a card that'll help you? Is it a card that could potentially help you down the road? No, then send it. But you know, I spent the entire week jamming mono blue, and Thassa, you know, the ability to scry every turn, it's pretty good.
You have the potential to see twice as many cards since you play her as you normally would, and that's just resource management. You know what I mean? It seems to me that Theros is all about resource management.
And, you know, and the more I played with Thassa, I didn't want to play Night Vale Spectre. on turn three, I wanted to get Thassa out on the board as soon as possible so I could start planning my turns ahead. You know, you need, if I needed that land to cast Master of Waves, well, I'm going to go digging for it. If I needed you know, a creature to turn on Devotion, I went digging for it. And you know, for anybody who spent time playing Delver a couple of years ago, the ability to cast Ponder and plan your next two or three turns, it's really good. You know, it gives experienced players a huge advantage, I feel like, especially in Constructed Format, where the decks are, I don't want to say, I don't think there's any one deck that right now has risen to the top of the pile. So a lot of these, you know, skill-based or decision-based cards like Thoughtseize or any Scry card gives any player with more experience a huge advantage.
You know, it's funny that you say that no particular deck has really risen above, because that kind of goes along with the statement that you had made earlier about, you know, you think Wizards has a responsibility to make a format where people have options of what to play.
Sure.
And there are a lot, you know, Scry is a very skill-intense mechanic, you know what I mean? The more experienced player and the more familiar you are with your deck and the meta, the better choices you're going to make on Scry. Cards like Thoughtseize about when to play it, what to be able to, you know, remove from your opponent and know what's the threat. These are very, very skill intense cards and mechanics. And, you know, because we haven't really seen a deck step up to the front, you have said this to me a bunch and we've kind of commented a lot. It's, you know, Sam Black kind of famously said, hey, we decided to do this deck because it seemed like it was a really good deck. And even the bad matchups were still only about 50-50.
Sure.
And that's really, really good odds for a deck. And that's what I'm finding in the standard meta, is that there isn't really the sort of rock, paper, scissors that we saw during Ravnica. This deck is good against this deck, but it gets swallowed by this deck. And you know, it was kind of a runaround, and then it got just to the point. Whenever you have a meta that's like that, Jund is always going to come out on top. Because it's not that Jund is the best deck, it's that Jund is the least worst deck.
Well, Jund, the thing with Jund, you play a 55-45 deck like that, it's got game against everything. Because,
right.
Because each individual spell in Jund was so inherently powerful that you could, you know, you just need to draw the right cards and you can beat anybody. That was one of the attractive things about Jund. And, I mean, thank God that a lot of those cards, like the mana has gone away. Because Jund in standard with Thoughtseize right now would be just devastating.
It'd be modern.
Exactly. Like, the ability to play with perfect information is spectacular. I spent some time testing a black-white mid-range deck against a control deck, and you can Thoughtseize them, you Sin Collected them. Do they have the counterspell? Do they have the sweeper? Do they have to... You know, are they short on lands? You can really plan into your turns what you want to do, and you know, two turns, three turns down the road. And you know, I was playing a match today against an Esper deck, and
I just want to point out, you piloted a black white deck today.
Yeah, and you have the ability just to look at his hand like, oh, you don't have the answers. Good, I'm going to start doing this. And I was stripping key cards out of his hands at opportune times. I saw that he didn't have certain lands to cast his Supreme Verdict, so I took you know, a Doomblade out of his hand. I saw that he was really lean. He was gonna have, his plan was to lean on Jace Architect of Thought to slow down my you know, my 2/1s, my 2/2s. So I took the Jace out of his hand. I saw that he was stuck on lands. He only had 4 lands and he had 2 Sphinx's Revelation. So I just kind of ignored those till later when I drew another Sin Collector and started stripping those two. It's a very powerful thing for your opponent not to be able to bluff you. Especially against a control deck.
Of course. So would you say that perhaps the meta is shaping itself to be one that is advantageous for experienced players? Like, because all these matchups are relatively even as far as, you know, the how decks are matched up. Like, one deck doesn't necessarily completely blow out another deck. Everyone seems to have tools against everybody nowadays, and A, that just makes your sideboard all the more important. But would you say that this is going to be a meta that's you know, favoring the skill intensive?
I think there are certain cards every now and then that are really skill intensive. Like I said earlier, Ponder. Like, I think right now, Thoughtseize. And those kind of cards give you a huge advantage. And I think we're starting to see it, where these black decks, they just want to jam Thoughtseize because it gives you the ability to disrupt your opponent's plan. You know, if their huge plan is hinging on one card or even two or three cards and you strip them of it, well, you know, it makes you winning the game a lot easier. For the measly price of one card and one black mana and two life, you could wreck your opponent's day. That's pretty good.
All right, so getting back into the deck lists here, where we were talking about the green red monsters deck. As we're kind of going through and talking about all these things, I'd like to maybe touch on a couple key points that you may have observed on, you know, things you can do to disrupt the deck. Because the matchups are so relatively even nowadays, you know, we're past the days of Callblade, we're past the days of Delver. I'm seeing a lot newer players having a higher rate of success when they come and play because these matchups are a little fairer going in. And I'd like to kind of equip people with the confidence to, you know, hey, you're staring down green red monsters. It's a really big, frightening deck. You know, how do you get around it? What can you do to kind of disrupt the game? So we're going to talk about that when we go through each deck, and we're on green red monsters right now. What can somebody sitting across the table do to really kind of disrupt that game plan and shut it down?
Couple ways about, you know, any sort of mid-range deck, especially like that where they're dependent on getting mana rampers out to cast their 4 and 5 drops, you go under them, you rush them. If they stumble on their mana, they miss a land drop, or if they're just playing, you know, they're playing lands one at a time and not getting any ramp, you can kill them or get them low enough before they're even out to get out the gate. Or you knock them down to 5-10 life, you put them into burn range. Okay, so they put out a 4/4, they put out a 5/5. Okay, well, you can hit them, you sacrifice a few creatures, boom, they're toast. These kind of red-green decks, they're also light on creature removal. One of the cards I found that was actually fairly effective against them is something just like Boros Reckoner. You know, it's a big guy. He's not the biggest dude, but if they've got a 10, if they've got a 7/7, they got to swing into it, and it's going to feel pretty bad.
Well, he always trades up, too. Exactly. It's great thing about Boros Reckoner. Yeah. So he always trades up, like... You can safely swing into Desecration Demon with a Boros Reckoner, because if they decide to block it, you just can kill it anyway.
I've always had a soft spot as well for threaten effects for things like Act of Treason against these green-red decks. Oh, you're going to cast a fatty? I'm going to take it and punch you in the face with it. So, you know, that's how traditionally, especially decks like Mono Red, have gotten through or gone under these green-red mid-range decks.
Amy lost a game yesterday because she had supersized her Colonian Hydra, and then somebody active treasoned it and swung back and hit her with it.
That feels pretty bad. you know, the another way just to beat these decks are, these decks, they tend to be vulnerable to, you know, A, sweepers, B, or B, a concentrated massive spot removal. A lot of your creatures are, you know, a lot of your resources are devoted to ramping, you know, cast these guys, you know, you got to be able to get the mana to cast these spells to make it worthwhile. So, like I said earlier, you know, you spent 3 or 4 turns ramping out into a Stormbreath Dragon, and even if you get hit in with the Stormbreath Dragon, you go to Monstrosity to Doomblade it. Have a nice day. Or, you know, you go through all this trouble, you get 2 or 3 creatures on the board, Supreme Verdict, poof, have a nice day. And as what's going to you're going to find to be a reoccurring theme, don't let them cast the fatties. You disrupt the mana dorks, or you just plain old thoughts, you strip it from their hand. You know, what's the point?
How much attention are you spending? Because, you know, we have, you know, the devotion deck, which is acting more like a combo deck, but it has so many different pieces that can kind of do multiple things. How much attention are you spending on the dorks? How much attention are you devoting to, you know, the planeswalkers? Do the planeswalkers come out and you just got to get them off the table immediately? Do you ignore them the way you do some other planeswalkers? How much, you know, are you... You're saying rush and go under them, but are you trying to, you know, condition yourself to have a little bit of patience waiting for the threat to try and disrupt him? Like, where is your attention on this deck?
With all things, it's situation dependent. I mean, Domri is a card that's been traditionally very good against aggro-based strategies, and a card like Sylvan Cartitude right now is actually excellent. It's an 0/3. And it's got hexproof.
Oh, yeah.
So it blocks two power creatures for days, and you have no real way to get rid of it unless they block it and you can Blood Rush a Gore Clan by it or something. So with all things, it depends on the situation. A lot of the times, if you got to look at what they're doing. Are they stuck on lands, or are they playing the land drops? Are they playing land drops regularly? Are they using Domri to dig for creatures, or are they using it as removal? It's always a situation dependent. You know, if you've got a lot of threats in hand and you don't mind losing a creature or two to Domri, then fine, ignore it and go to the dome. You know, sometimes if you're holding a Fanatic Amogus and your plan here is to drop a bunch of creatures and then just dome them in the face with Fanatic Amogus for 10, then you got to go after the Domri. I will say that the more you play the matchup, it's very dependent. What do you see out of them? Are they dropping a lot of guys? you know, a lot of mana dorks and you think they got something huge, or do you think they're stumbling and they're trying to use that Domri or Xenagos to buy time so they can get to those fatties? It's something, I wish I could give you a better answer, but it depends. It really does.
So pay attention, learn to read the situation so that you can make the best call, because you're going to be called to make that decision in the moment, not ahead of time.
At States, for the final, I played the green-red monster deck, and that the second game, I watched him cast Domri on 3 and then use his plus 1, but he missed his fourth land drop. So I had a rapid hybridization I had in hand that I was going to save for something like Polychronos or Stormbirth Dragon, but I watched him miss his fourth land drop, and when he plused one his Domri, wasn't a creature, so it was either a land or, you know, maybe another Planeswalker. And at that point, I'm like, uh-oh, well, what am I going to do here? I cast a Tidebinder Mage to tie up his Elvish Mystic, and I cast something else. I think I used the Rapid Hybridization to blow up a Xur'Tah Druid, and he got stuck on mana for the next 2 or 3 turns, and that allowed me time to build up my board, and eventually I just killed him with a Thassa.
Yeah, so you realized in the moment what the weakness was in his strategy and used it to exploit that and make it a bigger weakness. What are your thoughts between this deck and the Miyahara Devotion deck? Do you prefer one over the other? If so, which one? I know you've piloted the Monsters deck very briefly. I don't think you've had a chance to play the Miyahara deck because it does require a very odd collection of cards to kind of have on hand. I don't know too many people that are running around with 4 Garrick Caller of Beasts.
I look at that deck and it screams combo. I got a chance to play against it, and the amount of mana that deck can generate is absolutely astounding. However,
yeah, like I said, like we're literally using D10s to calculate how much mana is on the table and of what color.
I mean, my opponent today generated something like 17 mana. I was like, well, okay, that feels good. What are you going to do with it? Oh, you cast Garrick, plus 1, drew 3 or 4 creatures, dropped the Polychronos, and promptly wiped my board. felt pretty bad. You look at that deck, it's really threat light. It's not a ramp deck in the sense that the green-red deck is even more of like a mid-ranger ramp deck. It really is a combo deck. It's got so many pieces that are devoted to generating these outrageous sums of mana. And sometimes, you know, you look at the deck, you can ruin their plan with a well-placed Doomblade, a well-placed Hero's Downfall. The deck is very dependent, I feel like, on using Garrick Caller of Beasts. That's why there's 4 of them, to draw a bunch of cards, to get to those fatties. That's what makes cards like Domri and Garrick so powerful in these kind of decks. They give you access to these big creatures that you want to cast. They give you something to dump your mana into. Miyahara, in his deck, you know, he described it as a combo deck, and I think that's the perfect description of the deck. And with any combo deck, if you disrupt the pieces, then, you know, the combo falls apart.
I think the Devotion deck is a little better positioned right now than the Green-Red Monsters deck, but it definitely is something that is deceptive. And like Mihara said, it is a combo deck. It is like any other, you know, synergy-focused deck that requires a lot of cogs. You got to pilot it a little while to kind of figure out what's a good hand, what's a good play. I think we were all a little, ruby sunglassed about it when it first came out because of the potential to go big. But there is the unfortunate frequency of games that you play where all you draw are just mana dorks after mana dorks. I had somebody ultimate Xenagos today and hit 1 Burning Tree Emissary. Oh. Like, it just, the deck has more mana dorks than threats, and that can be a very, very hurtful ratio in games where you're trying to catch up.
Especially any sort of deck with dedicated spot removal, a deck
right,
like the Orzhov midrange deck or Esper. You know, if you don't, at some point, you've only got so many threats, and if they get run out, well, then you're up for a loss that round.
Yeah, as the meta continues, I think more people are going to become more familiar with the deck, and it is going to be much, much easier to disrupt.
Sure.
Okay, so moving on from there, let's talk about what you piloted today. We will get to Mono Blue, but we did talk about that a lot last week, but let's talk about the other kind of big breakout deck, which has seen some success today at GP Louisville. This is the white-black deck that a lot of people are going. People have started to figure out this sort of, you know, early white game that the white weenie provides mixed with the control elements of a black deck. Provide a very, very early game backed up by a very, very good late game. And I, when we talked about this deck last week with Vijay, I told him that I thought the idea was really, really good. But my concern was, like, of all the other decks in Theros right now, this one needs the most immediate work because this is not a strategy I think that will sustain itself as is. This is a list that needs to be tweaked immediately. And it seems like Patrick Chapin went back and revisited and tweaked it again a little bit.
Sure.
You played a slightly modified list today at today's game day. There was another guy there who was doing it to some success. Can you talk about maybe what some of the tweaks are and how is why is this deck running so well? Why is this working so well?
I mean, it packs your basic black suite. You've got your Thought Seizes. You've got your spot removals in Doomblade. You've got your Heroes Downfalls. It's one of those decks that has answers, lots of answers, and it can provide early pressure through things like Soldier Pantheon, Priest and Captain. It's got the and it's got everybody's favorite 6/6 right now, Desecration Demon.
He's a beast, man. He's even better now than he was before.
So the deck presents a lot of, you know, like Ryan said, it presents some mid game threats. It prevents you from just sitting there with a bunch of 1/1s, 2/1s, 2/2s, and feeling really bad about yourself when there's a Polychronos on the other side of the board. So it offers you game, like Jund last season, it offers you the ability to fight against little, you know, cast early creatures, to fight off aggro rushes. You've got Disruption to disrupt these mid-range decks. And if something slips through all that, you've got the cleanup. You've got the Doomblade, you've got the Hero's Downfall. It's a very consistent strategy from what I found. It's got some nice synergy with cards like Whip of Erebos and Obsidian. You've got the, you know, Ghost Daddy himself helping you gain life. You've got Blood Baron, a couple in the main, couple in the side, which I think is a very good card in the meta right now. With all these things like Doomblade and Hero's Downfall running around, well, guess what he's immune, guess what the Blood Baron's immune to? Doomblade and Hero's Downfall.
Well, and if Devotion continues to be a thing and two color decks continue to be a thing, I mean, you got to keep in mind, we talked about this during, you know, a couple weeks ago when Vijay and I were doing the episode where we were talking about, you know, what from Ravnica should you be paying attention to that maybe you ignored that was going to be good again. And one of the cards we touched on was Blood Baron of Viscopa. Mm. He is immune to 7 out of the 10 guilds of Ravnica. Mm. He is a really, really, really good card right now in the meta, and he seems absolutely phenomenal in the mirror.
Definitely.
I mean, he just dodges your opponent's entire deck.
One thing my opponent just kind of noticed today, like, I played a second one. He's like, oh, those aren't legendary. No, they're not legendary. You can have a lot of them out there, and you know, you can hold one back for defense and swing in with them. You can swing them back in, and you gain life. You know, life gain is always going to be good in a format that's as fast at, when we've got things like mono red or even mono blue devotion. Sometimes you need to buy a couple extra turns. You need a few life. It does it.
I'm always confused because he doesn't have vigilance, and I'm always expecting him to have vigilance.
Because he's not.
Because it seems like a card that would have vigilance, but he's got lifelink. He's got protection from black, protection from white. I mean, it's one of the reasons that I actually was really excited that a mono blue list came out, because red, he is 4 toughness. He's a 4/4. That's just out of the range of red without a card like Mizzium Mortars in hand when he casts it.
Definitely.
And, you know, a lot of the other quality decks, a lot of the, you know, Abrupt Decay, Putrefy, Doomblade, some of this like really high quality removal right now just cannot touch him. And so the thought of playing Mono Blue where I get access to Rapid Hybridization, I was like, oh, wait a minute. I can actually deal with that card,
mm-hmm.
Which is one of the reasons I like that deck so much. So what just, you know, you've been talking about Thoughtseize a fair amount on this show.
People always talk about pillars of the format. You know, whether it was last season you had things like Falcon Wrath Aristocrat or Sphinx's Revelation. I think right now Thoughtseize is a definite pillar of the format. I think it's the clear reason in the format right now to be playing black.
I mean, you've talked about it so much already, but I wanted to maybe put things in stone here on your opinions about do's and don'ts about Thoughtseize, because it is a card that costs you some life, it is a card that you can very easily make the wrong choice for when you, you know, it can win you the game turn one, it can mess up the game turn one. Can you talk about some clear do's and don'ts about Thoughtseize?
Well, I almost always side them out against aggro decks. You don't have both spare life to do it. I usually try not to cast Thoughtseize on, you know, more than one a turn. I mean, not just it's more than just being able to strip a card out of your opponent's hand. It's you get access to what all the cards they have in the hand. You want to be able to let them draw cards and see what it is they are drawing. And you know, pro tip: if you get to see their hand, write it down. So you don't forget later. I saw a situation earlier today where I watched my friend Thoughtseize somebody, and he saw an Aetherling in hand. He saw that his opponent had an Aetherling, and he had a Pithing Needle. My friend had a Pithing Needle in his hand, and all he had to do was, oh, look, I can put down this Pithing Needle, name Aetherling, and, well, that Aetherling's just going to be a vanilla 4/5.
Well, I should note that was against me. I had the Aetherlings, and not only did he cast the Pithing Needle, he cast it twice because I overloaded Cyclonic Rift. So he had two opportunities to say Aetherling.
And, you know, something like that. Like, if you know what your opponent's got, then plan around it. I think that's the first, like I said earlier, that's the most powerful thing about Thoughtseize. Look, I mean, when you Thoughtseize somebody, you see what they have. Just don't look at what they have. Look at what you have. Think about what you have in your deck. If they've got a card that you can't answer, you probably should get rid of it. I was playing against another black deck today. I Thoughtseized him. And I saw he was playing a Golgari deck, and he had, you know, he had a Reaper of the Wilds, he had a Desecration Demon, and of those cards that I couldn't deal with, well, I couldn't really deal with the Desecration Demon with all the Doom Blades I was holding. So and I got rid of the Desecration Demon because I saw that he didn't have green mana. So you take note of what they have and what you can't, you know, what can't you deal with? Is that card going to ruin your day? You know, and it sometimes, you know, it comes down by measures. If they cast this, do I have a chance at drawing an answer? You know, can I fight my way through it? Or is this card just going to be, they cast it and I scoop?
You touched on something that's actually a rule that I think most players don't know about, and that's about writing it down and taking notes. So I just wanted to take a second, as the L1 on this show, to discuss the rules of taking notes in a match. So the way that this works is that, you know, we always recommend, judges will always tell you if you're at any sort of competitive event, write down your life totals. There's a lot of, like, there's some countdown dice. There's a lot of really cool apps on your smartphones that you can do. And, they look really cool. They're electronic. They're keeping I have the tally, and that's fine. If you're going to use an electronic one, try and use one that makes a list of all the modifications to the life total so that when you go, yeah, I lost 3 life, it will actually tally a list of, like, he went -3, then he went -5, because that helps the judge go back. But the reason the judges suggest that you write it down is because if there's any discrepancy of the life total, they're going to say, well, we're going to go back through the game and try and remember when damage was dealt and how much damage it was dealt. And if one guy presents to me, you know, a list of how the damage went down and he's got it on his sheet and the other guy's just got a die there with a single number on it, a lot of judges, we really don't have the choice but to sort of go with the guy who's got it written down because that is a clear path that I can see. So having a pad and a pen with you is really, really important for your life total, but it also gives you access to a notepad to write down notes, especially if you're playing decks that run Thoughtseize where you have access to your opponent's hand. The reason is because any information that you are given during the game, you are allowed to write it down. And you may use that information throughout the match. Now, the thing that you have to keep in mind is that after the match, you're not allowed to consult those notes. And you're also not allowed to consult outside notes that you have taken during the event in another match. So say, for example, you write down some notes, right? And then you take those notes to another match and you happen to be playing against the same deck. So you Thoughtseized and you were playing mono blue and you wrote down what mono blue does. And then next round, you're sitting down against another mono blue deck. You're not allowed to retrieve those notes from the previous match and go, oh, I know that there are these cards in that deck and I now need to be aware of those cards. So the important thing to know is basically any notes you take during a match just get rid of them at the end of the match because there's a lot of penalties for using. It's kind of corrupted information when you take it outside. But you're also not really allowed to bring outside notes in. But the thing that's really, really confusing about some people is like, hey, I want to make sideboarding notes. What's the deal with that? You are allowed to bring information in to an event. For example, this weekend I've been playing this mono blue deck and I'm trying to remember what to do with the matchups because the sideboarding is very confusing. You are allowed to bring notes into the match, like sideboarding notes, for example, that say, if I'm playing the green-red matchup, this is how I want to sideboard. If I'm playing the Selesnya deck, this is how I want to sideboard. These are notes that you are allowed to bring in. But as with everything, if there's ever any confusion, just check with a judge. 9 times out of 10, checking with a judge prevents penalties rather than issues them. So just if there's any confusion, if you're nervous about whether or not you're doing something that might get you in trouble, just go talk to your local judge and say, hey, I'm going to game day or I'm going to a PTQ or something like that. Am I allowed to bring sideboarding notes for my deck against popular meta matchups? They're probably going to tell you yes, and they'll instruct you on how you can do that in the proper fashion.
And I think it's really important that you go into any tournament with a plan to sideboard. Unless you're winning all your matches 2-0, you're going to play more games post-board than you will pre-board. And I feel like that's a skill that a lot of players, I was a terrible sideboarder, and I'm still not very good at it. I feel like there's always places to improve. You want to have a plan for, you know, game 2 or game 3. You want to be like, this is what not only do I need answers to, what do I think they can bring in against me? You know, you go to next level as the term goes. I think a lot of players will just grab a few cards. Oh, I don't think that's good. Oh, I don't think that's good. Oh, let's see what happens if I pull one of these. I think that's a bad way to go about it. Your sideboard is one of your most powerful tools. It can make an unwinnable matchup, you know, 50-50. It can give you a clear advantage in the match. And it's very important you go into these tournaments, you know, you start going to your local FNM. It's like, if I'm playing X deck and I come up against this matchup, these are the cards I want in. These are the cards I want out. You get in the habit of doing it, and it becomes just rote, just like muscle memory.
Yeah, here at Midrange Magic, you guys know if you've been listening to us for a long time, we are really, really big, big supporters of the sideboard. Like, to me, that really is the difference of, you know, people who can take down long events is your ability to adapt and your ability to plan ahead for what you expect in the meta. Your sideboard should be changing constantly if you are paying attention to the meta. And especially now in Theros, especially when the matchup ratios are as evened odds as they are, your sideboard is really going to make the difference during your day about what you can do. I had instances today where even a one of. I won matches after the sideboard with cards I had brought in to face down an opponent. I had a big upset that caused the tie that prevented me from getting first place today from a sideboard card that, you know, I got fogged and ended up with a tie instead of a win. And that guy got first place on tiebreakers today. So, you know, the sideboard now more than ever seems to be really, really important. And with all of the cards, like, there are a lot of cards in Ravnica that just do everything. Like, there's so many things in Ravnica that just does, and just even minute variations. Let's do bounce target creature. Now let's do bounce all attacking creatures. Now let's overload Cychronic Rift and bounce all permanents. Like, there are so many levels on what exactly you are trying to do that there really is a card out there for everything in this current meta in Standard.
Whenever building a sideboard, it's easy just to copy a list and be like, oh, okay, these are the cards going to play out. You want to, you know, these are lists that the pros play, and they build their sideboards based on what the expected metagame will be. You want to look at the people that you play with. You want to look at your local shops. You want to look at your friends, and you'll be like, these are the decks that I expect them to play. Is this a good matchup for me? Then fine. I don't need to dedicate, you know, 5-6 slots to it. If this is a, but if it's a bad matchup for you, you can, you know, 5-6-10 cards. Against it, when playing mono blue, I would bring anywhere from 7 to 10 cards against the matchup, and it bought me and the post board. I felt a lot better than I did, you know, game one.
Well, it's another reason that Thoughtseize is such a powerhouse in the meta right now is because oftentimes you can cast Thoughtseize, you know, on your opponent in game two, game three, and you might get a peek at a card that they brought in against you, and you can then get further insight into what they're thinking on how they are going to beat you. And it's that information that says, hey, you know, you're using Thoughtseize, you're writing down the cards that you see, you're crossing them off once your opponent plays them, and then you're going, ah, I see that sideboard card you got in, and you're going, okay, this is my opponent's hand. What is their turn one play? What is their turn two play? What are they thinking about doing against me? And how can I disrupt that, and how can I plan against that so I don't play a card into their counter spell, so I don't play a creature into their removal spell, or so that I, you know, I play the right turn two creature and keep Tidebinder Mage for the Polykranos as opposed to running it out for the Mana Dorm.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, but on the opposite end of that, just because it happened to me today, you know, some combat against Thoughtseize is you have to be aware that people are going to be Thoughtseizing you now. Like, black is becoming a thing. Mono Black Devotion. You know, Brian Bronduin won it today at GP Louisville. You know, there were, I think, three mono black decks in the top
something
eight.
Like that.
You know, the Star City guys were doing really well. You know, this white black deck, this, you know, sort of Paul Rietzel, Patrick Chapin deck is
the other SCG deck.
It's got a lot of, well, I say SCG Varsity. And you know, it's got a lot of gas to it. And you know, Esper control is the thing. You have to be prepared for people thought seeing you. So, what do you do when you're on that other end of the table? You know what I mean? Like, you're now in a situation where your opponent has all of the information and you still have half of the information. Well, you have a couple of you know, strategies. Like, yeah, you play the cards that they know, but, you know, there is some value to having secrets in your hand. You may want to hold back on some things. I had an issue today where I was playing against one of these white-black decks, and I got Thoughtseize turn one every game. And, you know, the first thing that was Thoughtseize was one of my Night Vale Spectres because it happened to be very, very good in the matchup. And he just went, I'll take one of your Night Vale Spectres. And I import very conscientiously took the one out of my hand that was not the promo one, because I knew that three out of the four Night Vale Spectres I was playing were promo Night Vale Spectres.
So what's Ryan saying? That he drew another.
Right. Well, I did that because now I know that if I were to draw more Night Vale Spectres, my opponent is not going to recognize that I played a different one.
It's just the one he thought he was holding. And that, right. I mean, there's always value to that, especially if you
have... Well, I caught him because I played another one later in the game, and he goes, oh, I didn't know you had another one. Like, I wasn't ready for another one.
I mean, little things like if you're one of those people like I am, I'm guilty of it, I like having... pretty lands. I like having my hinge lands. I have beta lands. And, you know, if your opponent's, you know, paying attention, they know they see an island in your hand. Is it the one they've seen before, or is it what you've just drawn? It's information. It's all information. The more information you have, the more chance you have of success.
Right. And sometimes you can give things away. And you have to keep in mind, too, with Thoughtseize, is pay attention to what your opponent is taking away from you. A lot of times the guys playing Thoughtseize give away more than they are aware of because they are taking certain things. Like, I've got some good creatures that are very, very difficult for my opponent to deal with, but he Thoughtseizes my Planeswalker instead of my good creatures. That tells me that he's confident he has things in his hand to deal with my creatures.
He's got a Doomblade instead of a Hero's Downfall.
He's, you know, he's packing that. Whereas he's like...
Or he's got a Syncopate instead of Essence Scatter. Something like that.
Right. Or I really want to take this card instead of this card. A lot of times your opponent can, you know, if my opponent thought seizes and he takes away one of my prime removal spells, that tells me that he's afraid that removal spell is going to kill a very important creature that he has in his hand, and he wants to protect that creature as best as he can. So that means, hey, I got to be wary for something big that might be coming after, you know, hey, yeah, there's a Boros Reckoner, but maybe there's a Stormblade Dragon coming behind the Boros Reckoner that I might want to hang on to that Doomblade for maybe another turn or two before I commit it.
This all comes back down to planning. And I feel like what separates a good why I think I have success is I go into every match with a plan to win. Like, I always think of this, how in the hell do I plan on winning this game? Do I just, you know, you don't want to go in there like, I'm just going to draw cards and throw them out there and see what happens. And everybody likes to think that, oh, I go in there, I'm going to win. How are you going to win? You know, how am I going to win this particular matchup? How am I going to win game one of this matchup? How do I plan on winning future games of this matchup. It's like, oh, it's not just, I hope I draw the right stuff, or I hope my opponent mulligans into oblivion. It's, no, this is how I plan on winning a game. And I think that's where people, that's where people take the next step. It's not just going out there and casting spells, or even sequencing your spells in the right order. It's, how do I plan on winning this game?
What am I going to need? And a lot of that has to do with knowing your meta well, which is one of the reasons we're spending this week focusing on it so much on this episode. So, again, thanks for joining us. All right, so you're sitting across the table from the white-black deck. How do you disrupt this deck? What can you do to take this deck down?
A lot of the times you're playing this black-white deck, it kind of feels like a Jund deck a little bit from last format. Half the deck is removal and disruption, half the deck is creatures. It's really dependent on its bigger creatures. Cards like Desecration Demon, Blood Baron, Obsidat to close out a game sometimes, especially if you can gum up the board a lot. A lot of the times, you know, if all they've got out there are Priests and Captains and Soldiers of Pantheon, they don't get to their mid-range guys. You know, the deck will stumble on land. It doesn't have perfect mana. A lot of the spells are double white, double black, you know, black and white. So there's a huge penalty to playing this deck in that you've got a lot of powerful spells, but the mana requirements are very high. So you're playing 4 temples and 4 guild gates and 4 godless shrines, so sometimes you're playing a turn behind. Also, like, there's always the penalty to playing these black cards. Black for as long as I remember, since the days of Necros, if you want to draw cards, you got to pay life.
Yeah, so the thing with black, it's the flavor of black, is it will try and do some of the things that blue does, but there is that penance of the flesh that comes with it. You know, Read the Bones costs you 2 life. Thoughtseize costs you 2 life. Playing some of these lands on tap that you really need to generate the tempo, you gotta pay 2 life with a lot of this stuff.
So I was playing against an Esper deck today, and I did 30 damage, 20 to him and 10 to myself, between things like Shock Lands and Thoughtseize and Read the Bones. So, you know, the deck, you know, it's a lot of 1-for-1. Black removal is all 1-for-1 right now, and a lot of the times that's just fine. But at some point, there's 25 lands in the deck because you need to be able to reliably hit your land drops, and you can flood out. You cannot draw the removal, or maybe you don't draw your life gain creatures. You don't draw your Blood Baron. You don't draw your Obsidian. And you put yourself in a pretty precarious position sometimes. I think that's one of the reasons why there's Fiend Slayer Paladin in the sideboard against a lot of the more aggressive matchups. I find myself siding out cards like Thoughtseize and Read the Bones against the aggressive matchups, which is good because you really can't spare the life, but then you lose your ability to disrupt. You lose your ability to draw cards later on. You're really leaning on, you know, the overall power of your creatures individually to win a lot of those matchups sometimes. You know, even a card like Underworld Connection, which is great in the control mirror, I wouldn't bring it in against anybody else. You know, you can only take so much damage over the course of the game, and, you know, that's what black does.
Yeah, it seems to be a deck, like I said, I thought it needed to be tweaked, and probably is a deck that needs to be tweaked constantly because the ratios are very, very obscured. You have a lot of removal, you have a lot of little guys, you have a few big threats to kind of close out the game, but working those into a perfect ratio of what you want for any particular matchup is highly down to variance, and it is a deck that I think rewards really, really masterful play. It is by no means an autopilot, but I have found in the 2 weeks that it's kind of been around that if you are playing, you know, in a board state where it is a very gummed up battlefield, you know, it is the pressure is on the white black deck to start coming up with the answers to kind of take it over, while some of the other decks can kind of just sit back and wait for the win condition. And that can be very, very, you know, pressed for the colors of white and black because they don't sort of naturally have the resources that let them dig for that normally.
Definitely.
Okay, so, you know, devotion is being a thing. Mono red devotion is a thing. Mono blue is obviously doing really well. And now 3 mono black devotion decks, you know, top 8ed Grand Prix Louisville. Brian Braun doing 1 with one of the mono black decks. We saw a mono black devotion deck top 8ed at Theros. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this now, because when we were prepping for States, you and I usually play test together. I wasn't able to go to States because of, you know, relationship commitments. But, you know, one of the things that we were main focusing is, you know, should we take this mono blue deck, or does Wiley want to take this mono black deck that looks like it could have some stuff to it? And during playtesting, we all but threw the deck in the garbage. Like, it just did not
The problem,
run.
Well, we were testing primarily the mono black versus the mono blue
right.
matchup, and I kind of felt like we'd run into these problems. I was the one piling the mono black list, and the problem that I was running into is the mono black deck has a lot of one for one removal, and my feeling against like a deck like mono blue is the deck has 30 creatures, anywhere from 28 to 30 creatures, and a lot of and a few non blue permanents to go with it. So unless you're drawing all the single target removals, all the disruption, eventually I'm going to get something online. And, I felt like the black deck, it was doing a lot of damage to itself with things like Thought Seizing. If you're spending time killing your opponent's creatures, it's hard for you to develop your own board. You look at a card like Desecration Demon, it's a great card, but if your opponent's, if your opponent has resolved Master of Waves and you have no way to take care of it, they've got eight, even five, six tokens, they'll buy themselves a lot of time and eventually just kill you.
Okay, so looking at Brian's list here, now that we've seen some slight alterations to it, I mean, what is it about the mono black deck that seems to be functioning so well? Because we sit down with these devotion decks, and it's very easy to see why the mono blue deck works so well. You've got a card like Master of Waves, which is one of these mythic rares that relies on devotion, and boy, does it do wonders when you actually get it out. And Thassa is an incredibly powerful god. She comes down on turn three. She controls your draws. She makes things unblockable. It's very, very easy for her to utilize her godlike potential. And as we start running through some of the other gods, we're like, yeah, Purphoros seems like it'd be pretty easy to get devotion off of. Heliod seems kind of woefully underpowered because playing mono white doesn't seem very good with the rotation of Innistrad.
Champion of the Parish.
Innistrad was essentially white against all the other colors, so white was loaded up with some really, really good cards, a lot of fast stuff for an aggressive matchup. Without that, Heliod just seems kind of nothing. Nylea, there is a mono green deck that saw a little flare, but again, mono green has very little flexibility. It can't interact, so you kind of just try and build and run over. What is it about black that seems to work? I mean, of all the gods, Erebos to me seemed the least exciting.
I hate to keep beating a dead horse here, but the real draw to black right now, obviously, Thoughtseize. I mean, it's where it starts. You want four of them. You can use it. You don't have to really deal with the Thassa if you just pluck it out of their hand.
Well, it also, I think the other really, really attractive thing about black is it's got just primo removal with the Print of Heroes Downfall. Now black doesn't have to ally itself with red in order to deal with
planeswalkers,
which is kind of it's kind of a hard thing for black to deal with. And its creatures are usually underpowered. It usually can't deal with planeswalkers very, very well. And,
black historically hasn't really been able to deal with non-creature permanents.
Right.
Even all the way back to the days of, Alpha, Beta, Unlimited, Ice Age, whatever.
It has no enchantment disruption. It has no artifact disruption. It's just not designed to do that. And not only that, but with the printing of Heroes Downfall, just to touch on that card for a moment, it has allowed a deck like the white-black deck to function without needing to be a white, black, and red deck. We have seen a little bit of that peering up and down, but I have seen all of those players who have been, in that early, we still got some really, really good Boros cards, some good, Orzhov cards, let's marry them together, let's have this really good red, white, black deck, they're going, we can just kind of drop the red and have a slightly better running deck with kind of the same idea in mind. So when you're packing, Doomblades, Heroes Downfalls, and Thoughtseize, that's like 12 cards right there that take away a great number of threats your opponent's going to be playing against you.
Black is, as always, well, this iteration of Mono Black offers like premier disruption. It offers premier removal, and my favorite card in the deck, I mean, Garius, a lot of people especially call him, but Grey Merchant of Asphodel.
Seems to be a big attractor to a black devotion.
I had the opportunity at one of the pre-release events for Theros to play Mono Black. I picked the black box, and it just happened that my pool had three Grey Merchants in it. And I was, I kind of said, screw it, I want to try it. This card looks fun. And so I found myself playing just a bunch of subpar black creatures cards, like Fellhide Minotaur, the Blood Toll Harpy. And then there were, even cards like Disciple of Fennax. And, I mean, Moog's Marauder is a good card by itself. But I was like, screw it. I'm going to throw all these cards in one deck and let's see what happens. And more than a few times, it was kind of like, oh, look, I'm going to cast Grey Merchant and drain you for 9. Great, I'm going to gain 9 too. Next turn, I'm going to cast Grey Merchant and drain you for 11. See you next round. It feels really powerful to do stuff like that. These current mono blacklists, you know, they obviously, like we said earlier, black, you want to draw cards, you pay a price to do it. And these cards, this deck has definitely kind of tried to shore up its weaknesses by playing cards like Whip of Erebos. And, you know, obviously Grey Merchant as ways to gain life. Because, you know, if you want to draw cards, you got to pay life. And, you know, I think Erebos is another card that's, you know, I wouldn't run more than maybe one or two, but one main or something like that. It shuts down Sphinx's Revelation's ability to gain life. And, you know, a lot of these other small aggro decks, they've got cards to gain life. Something even simple like Soldier Pantheon, where a few points of life will swing a huge game. You know, the Erebos will shut it down, man. Sometimes you turn him on and he's just a big dude to beat somebody in the face with.
And the other thing is, I'm going to pause this.
Okay.
This also seems like a deck that, if it becomes really, really popular, is also really, really well positioned for the mirror. You know, you're looking at a card like Dark Betrayal, possibly the best of the 5 self-hating color cycles. You're talking about a 1-mana remove black creature spell. 1 mana to kill something without any side effect other than color, you know, requirements. So, you know, this deck, if the white-black deck is a thing, if the mono-black starts to be, you know, peering up in the meta over the next couple of weeks, this seems like a deck that you can be very, very confident in piling, because it seems like in Brian's list, he's only packing 2 Doomblades and 2 Devour Flesh, so that he's only really kind of losing 2 of his removal spells and then replacing them with, you know, equivalent stuff out of the sideboard. But then if Doomblades happen to be favorable, he's able to bring some of those back in out of the sideboard. It's a very, very interesting list. How you feeling about, you know, Night Vale Spectre in the main over Lifebane Zombie? You know, Packrat, is Packrat seem like the, you know, does he have the potential to be the powerhouse and standard that he is in Limited? Man, possibly the second greatest Limited card ever made?
Man, I was happy to watch Ravnica Draft go, just not to have to face a Packrat again, because turn 2 Packrat was just one of the worst things.
We even did one for fun. In the middle of the summer, our shop was like, hey, I got all these old packs. Do you guys want to draft Ravnica? You want a Ravnica block? And I was like, yeah, I'll do that. That was fun. I haven't played it in 2 months. Let's break it out. So we broke it all out. And then right at the end, I sat down. And what did somebody open? Packrat. And I had to play it again. I was so mad.
I think it's really cool that Packrat doesn't make tokens. He makes copies of himself.
Yeah.
Which obviously adds to your devotion total. I mean,
well, it makes tokens that are a copy of himself.
Right. And I think it's really cool. Just against some of these matchups, like if they don't have sweepers, you got the Packrat. Cast it and go. Just see what happens. Because at some point, if your opponent, you know, a lot of these aggro decks are really light on removal, and if they're casting 2/2s and 3/3s, and the thing with Packrat, he's exponential. You go from 3/3s to 4/4/4s to 5/5/5s, and they can't deal with it.
No.
You know, and I think, you know, I'm happy to see the card with some constructed play.
I'm also really happy that Ratchet Bomb is back.
Yeah, for that reason specifically. I like the move of Night Vale Spectre into the main board and Lifebane Zombie into the sideboard. Lifebane Zombie is obviously a very, very powerful creature, but a lot of these green and what Selesnya-based aggro decks are kind of dying down. They're getting shoved by the wayside. But
I feel like green hate is... I feel like there's still a lot of very viable green strategies out there and red strategies. And in the same way that Mono Blue has been a smart meta call because, you know, Tidebinder Mage has a lot of targets, I feel like the same thing goes for Lifebane Zombie. It gets green or white creatures, which almost seems more relevant.
It was kind of like Mana Leak a couple seasons ago, where like where people aren't. It's better when it's not when people aren't expecting it or playing around it. So as the effectiveness of these color hate cards will obviously just go up and down based on what other people are playing. But I think the deck is obviously good. It just won the Grand Prix, putting 3 copies in the top 8. But like I said, with these decks, they're really dependent on being able to one for one you until they can get a big creature out there that you can't deal with. You know, the deck's got to build up to the point where, hey, they've killed all your little threats, and now here's something, can you deal with it? Whether it's a Desecration Demon or it's just a big bad gray merchant, you know, to drain you for a bunch of mana. Like, have they got, have they established a board presence to do something about it? I mean, I look at the deck, it looks really consistent, and like I said with black, it offers you a lot of disruption, especially post board. You can set against a control deck, you side out a lot of your useless spot removal, you bring in more cards like Duress, you bring in another card like Erebos, little things like that. I mean, again, it comes back to playing with perfect information and having a plan of how are you going to attack the specific matchups.
All right, so two things I want to ask you about this deck before we jump into how to beat it. You know, the mana base is, you know, these mono decks are allowing us the freedom to play Mutavault, which is obviously a very, very versatile card. And
love it.
Very, very helpful. But, you know, your thoughts on the two Temple of Deceits that seem to be in there purely for the occasional Scry ability?
Yeah, it's, again, I kind of poo-pooed Scry. Like, I didn't think it was that great until I started using it. Again, it comes back to me, like, is this card on top something I can use? No, ship it. Dig for something that can be useful in the situation. I don't think I'd go overboard and run more than maybe two, because the penalty of having lands come into play tap, sometimes it takes just that one time to burn you when you really need the untapped land to be able to cast two things, or even cast your, you know, that desecration demon you need to apply pressure. It makes a difference.
I'm also seeing no Read the Bones. Do you feel like that's a card that should be in there? Is Ultimate Price, or is Underworld Connections enough?
I go back and forth on Read the Bones. I think it's very useful in certain matchups and it's absolutely horrible in a lot of other matchups. You know, you're paying three mana, and sure, you can set up the top of your deck. Sure, you're going to draw the two cards. I find myself siding the card out a lot, unless it's like a control matchup where I'm not worried about my life total. Again,
is it a card that's good when you're ahead, but maybe not quite so good when you're behind?
You know, it's not just being able to draw the card, you know, whether you're behind or ahead. It all comes down to context. When you look at the situation, I don't want to be able to cast a card where if I'm getting punched in the face for five a turn by a Voice of Resurgence and a Fleece Mainline. Last thing I want to do on the planet is cast Read the Bones, even though I may really need it. So I don't know where it's obviously a good card, but it's going to come down to the point where where you cause so much damage to yourself with things like Thoughtseize and Underworld Connections. I think I'd rather have Underworld Connections for the on-demand ability, even if it means drawing a useless card sometimes.
And with, you know, we've got one Erebos in the main board, one Erebos God of the Dead in the sideboard. You know, these devotion decks seem to revolve around, you know, having obviously the devotion. You know, in this particular case, it seems to really be setting up Grey Merchant of Asphodel. But, you know, it's really, really impossible to ignore these very, very powerful, indestructible god cards. In the devotion deck, how big of a role does he play in here? I mean, you know, it's very, very easy to see why Thassa, in the blue deck, you're setting up devotion so that you can have Thassa because she's going to win you more games than anything else. Why do you feel like this deck isn't trying to press, you know, getting Erebos on the table and getting him off quite so much?
I mean, Thassa is a completely different beast. The ability to make herself unblockable is what I think pushes Thassa. I mean, not only does she come down on turn three, she has the ability to make herself unblockable. So for two mana, I'm going to Lava Axe you to the face. She's indestructible. I mean, she's great. You've got a Nykthos on the board. Even if excess mana on the board, you can make your entire team unblockable. I think that's what makes Thassa more powerful, especially in a mono blue aggro deck where you've got a lot of creatures who might not be great in combat. But hey, if you can't block them, you're not going to do much about them. Erebos, he doesn't offer anything I think particularly game breaking. If you shut down life gain, sure, it matters. The ability to pay, you know, one a black a one and two and a life to draw a card. Powerful ability, but you can't have too many of those effects.
Sure.
But
he's a 5/7. I mean, he seems like a great guy to kind of get in the way of your opponent who's trying to put on the early pressure while you're picking off the threats, and then you have the room to come through with the win.
I mean, I look at these mono black decks, and like they're not as heavy permanent wise as, say, like the mono blue deck, or the mono green decks, or the mono red decks. The cards you're depending on to create devotion with cards with mono black. You're looking at cards like your Desecration Demons, your Night Vale Spectres. The deck itself is very threat light. It's not a very heavily permanent based deck because you spend so many slots on disruption and removal. I don't think you can reliably turn him on, which is why I think the deck doesn't run that many copies of Erebos.
Okay, so, you know, mono blue is still a thing. I don't think we have to get too far into it because we did kind of talk about it at great length. But, you know, you used it to win states. There's no doubt that the deck has something to it. And even this weekend, I think people were a little nervous, like, how quickly is mono blue going to run its course? How quickly are people going to be able to sideboard and hate against it? I mean, you know, we've got cards like Skylasher, we've got cards like, you know, Mistcutter Hydra. I mean, there is a lot of, like, direct hate against mono blue. What does it have that, you know, sort of maintains the staying power in the way that, you know, something like mono red that just gets hated out immediately as soon as it pokes its head back up?
Well, the thing that mono blue to me right now is the best aggro deck in the format. When you can curve out the deck, you know, one drop, two drop, Thassa, Master of Waves, they're just decks that just can't deal with it. It puts people in a position where if you don't have an answer right away, you're gonna lose. And I think that's what makes a great aggro deck. Where you just draw that right hand and I don't care what people are doing, you're dead. I mean, I played against mono red twice and I kind of felt there was, I mean, they felt like, what are you gonna do against me? As long as I land a Master of the Waves, have a nice day. I think the obvious draw to the deck is Thassa. Like I said earlier, you turn her on, she's a two mana lava axe every turn that your opponents are going to have a hell of a time getting rid of. Short of you being able to cast a sweeper or you have an exile effect, the mono blue deck packs so many blue based permanents that the chances of her being turned on, they're very good. And when she's active, good God, watch out. She puts a huge psychological pressure. And we haven't even gotten to the point where we talk about her scrying, the ability to filter your deck again every turn. I mean, to me, it's like...
You just mentioned the word that I wanted to touch on today because I was explaining to a newer player. I sat down against somebody who plays a little bit today and they were like, oh, man. And you feel bad because I am the judge of the shop. You know, you and I used to get the same way when I had to sit down across from you. And I still do to an extent today. It's not going to be an easy match. You know, you're going to have to actually put in some effort and you got to sit down and you think about it. And that can be very daunting. And I think that's one of the things about this deck that is sort of this added bonus is it's very distracting. There's a lot of things going on that are very attention demanding, but not necessarily the thing you need to be worrying about. And I wanted to get your opinion on that. You know, what is sort of priority number one when facing this deck? Or, you know, maybe it's situational, but you're sitting across from the mono blue deck. What do people need to be worrying about instead of being distracted by this flash that is, oh my God, blue cards coming at my face in an aggressive fashion? Black is white, up is down, dogs and cats living together.
Blue is the best aggro deck in standard
right now. Right? Like, what mono blue aggressive? It's baking my brain.
You know, I look at the deck, and if, again, like I said earlier, with this deck, I'd say there are about 50 cards that I'm really happy to play. There are 10 cards I'm really not happy to play. You want Thassa is a huge distraction, and when I play with the deck, I want, if I have a choice between casting Night Vale Spectre or Thassa on turn 3, I want to get Thassa out there because she's just a ticking time bomb. People are going to look at the card and be like, crap, what are you going to cast the next turn? Is he going to turn on Thassa and he's going to punch me in the face? I mean, just a little thing like that where people get all worried about devotion. You want them to start, especially in a deck with a lot of spot removal, if you're getting them to Doomblade things like your Night Vale, Doomblade things like your Judge's Familiars or your Cloudfin Raptors or even your Tidebinder Mages, and then you can have, you know, devotion in a can, as I call Night Vale Spectre. That's what it is. You turn on Thassa and you go to town. I mean, my plan against a lot of the aggro decks, against any aggro deck, is just to kind of sit behind my 1/3s, my 1/4s, evolve Cloudfin Raptor a few times, because at some point I'm going to draw Thassa, I'm going to land her, and I'm going to make my team unblockable and you're going to die. Even against a mid-range deck, she poses a real threat, especially a lot of these mid-range decks, the green-red decks that lean real heavily on overloading a Mizzium Mortars or casting Domri and using it to fight your dudes. They can't really deal with or resolve Thassa. And the ability just to sit there, and again, I keep on coming back to it, you plan your turns. You've got, you know, five, you've got seven lands on the board, you know, and you never want to see another land again. You get the choice, you know. I'm looking at my land, that's the top part of my library. Oh, that's an island, don't want it. Gives you a lot of threat density with the deck. You look at these decks and you've got 24 lands, but in reality, I don't count those Mutavaults as lands. They're just more threats.
I took your strategy to heart this weekend and was able to use my Mutavaults much, much better because I've had difficulty with the card. I haven't really played with the card very much in the past, and I found that I was relying on it too much as a land and was realizing that I was like, why am I even playing these cards? They're just lands. They're not doing anything in it. And I took that strategy to heart this weekend and found a lot more success, you know, with the deck.
You know, I feel like Master of Waves is the flashy card in the deck, but the card that does the most work consistently is Thassa. I mean,
do you just shove her down turn three as quick as you can?
Generally, yeah. Unless I'm expecting counter magic, I mean, I'm gonna send her out there and start letting her apply pressure, having her help me filter my draws. She's great. She's the reason to play the deck, if you ask me.
Absolutely. Raphael Levy, for those of you who are listening, wrote an article. By the time you listen to it, it will be last week, so last Thursday, maybe last Friday. Raphael Levy was part of the team that a lot of the TCG player members tested for. He was on the team with the two guys who were in the finals, and they built a mono blue deck as well.
Team Revolution.
He built he wrote a really, really nice article talking about the deck. There's a lot of unnecessarily filler in the beginning that talks about the trip, but he, whenever you guys see a deck list that you like, try and look around and see if any pro players have written a write-up on it, because a lot of times, especially on TCG Player, they really structure their articles very, very well. And he writes some sideboarding reports about, sideboard this way against this deck, this way against that deck. And it's really important if you can find those. You're going to find success with the decks, especially when you get to the list where he says, take out all eight of your one drops for the matchup against white-black. Mm-hmm. And you're like, wait, what? Okay, and then I did that this weekend, and I was like, oh, wow, this was exactly the right move. Also, look at TCG Player this coming week, because Wiley Mock will have an article up about his trip through states at Illinois, I believe.
Assuming TCG just decides what I write isn't a total piece of garbage.
Oh, and they may decide not to post it, but keep on, so if you know it, you can say, hey, that's Wiley Mock. You can finally get a chance to see what he looks like.
Oh, Christ.
And it will be, it will be further metagame breakdown and information for you guys. So let's talk about Mono Blue's weaknesses. It's so distracting. It's the deck that Sam Black has personally decided to play. What in God's green earth could you possibly do to stop this deck?
Well, again, Thassa she's big and bad and scary, and she's the reason to play the deck. Don't let her get her out of your opponent's hand. Thoughtseize it, counter it. Don't let her get out there, because once she's on the board, it's inevitable at some point that they're going to turn on Devotion, unless you've got sweepers, unless you draw all the removal. Thassa's going to go active sometimes.
And unless you're playing blue, if she's on the table without like Selesnya Charm, it's pretty much impossible to get her off the table. So she's still doing work.
Mm-hmm. And Master Wave is obviously a flashy card. He's fairly fragile, though. If you've got easy ways to kill him, fine. Whether it be something as simple as a Golgari Charm or a Doom Blade, little thing. Farika's Curse is a fine card to answer it. Because once you look at the rest of the creatures in Mono Blue, not very good. I mean, I enjoy playing Night Vale Spectre, but he's only a 2/3. I somehow accidentally almost evolved Cloud from Raptor to a 5/6, but I don't think you're ever going to see him more than a 2/3 or maybe a 3/4 on any sort of regular basis. So you've got all these little, weenie type creatures. Even I wouldn't, something like Omenspeak, which is only one power, Judge's Familiar, which is only one power. You've got a collection of underpowered creatures to fuel your huge Master's Waves to turn on your Thassas. So if you can keep them off their, the big cards, they're going to have to beat at you, they're going to have to pick at you really slowly with their Frostburn Weirds, with their Omen Speakers or Tidebinder Mages, and at some point, if they don't have the big guns, you can go over the top of the deck.
Sure, definitely. All right, so the last deck that we have this week that kind of demands that we talk about it is Esper Control, which is funny because I'm not really – this is a deck that I think you're least likely to see around the FNM scene. I think people are really, really excited about playing with the new cards. The newer decks are a little bit easier to piece together as far as, you know, just being monocolored. There's a lot of commons and uncommons you can get your hands on. So if you weren't really already playing Control – you know, beforehand, you may not have access to a playset of Verdicts or Revelations or Jay's Architect of Thought, who's already, you know, he's back up to, what, $25, something like that?
Something like
that. Yeah, so he's back up into sort of the range that he probably deserves to be in as far as of playability. But, you know, Guillaume Wafotapa top aided with it.
Surprise.
Surprise. Guillaume Wafotapa was playing... Esper Control. It's funny, actually, if you read Raphael Levy's list, there's a funny little joke in there about his discussion with Guillaume, because Guillaume was on the playtest team, and he was like, Guillaume, I'm sorry, we can't help you playtest this deck because none of us want to play it. And he's like, well, this is kind of all I play, so I'm going to do this and do better than anyone else on the team, except for the two guys who won it. But so, you know, Esper Control, obviously, the big draw to playing this is Elspeth, Sun's Champion.
Sphinx's Revelation.
I mean, this is one of the decks to me that is still packed with Ravnica goodies. You're still playing Aetherling. You're still playing Jace.
Well, the Azorius Shard lost so little in rotation.
Right, right. Totally. And we saw people really, really trying with the blue-white decks. But again, I think black just has so many answers now with M14 and with Theros. That it's kind of silly for you not to try and play Esper over just straight up blue-white. So talk about the deck. What is working so well with this deck? Why is this form of control working so much better than any other versions?
Well, first of all, I think control decks are best in a defined metagame when you know the threats. Because just by their very nature, control decks, they pack answers. And, you know, the deck is half answers, maybe, you know, three or four win cons and lands. Because that's the nature of how control deck works. So when you've got a wide open format like we did last season, control decks weren't as powerful because there's too many things to do. There are too many things to answer. You look at these three-color decks, and what they have is, again, black for disruption and spot removal, because that's what it's great at. That's why, that's the reason to go into that third color. Sure, it makes you weak to Burning Earth, but red's on the downfall. They've got...
Well, there's no real reason to play. I mean, I think the green-red deck is the only one playing Burning Earth just because it is very weak to Esper naturally, but there's very, very little three-color decks out there. And you know, we mentioned before, Burning Earth was a great summer fling, but it does not have a whole lot of relevance moving forward in the meta.
Well, the awesome thing about Esper right now is between Detention Sphere, Hero, and Hero's Downfall, you kill anything that snuck through your counter magic, or anything you don't want to deal with, just get rid of it. You know, you've got the Premier Sweeper in the format right now in Supreme Verdict. My problem with the deck stems from the fact that you take a lot. There's 12 shock lands in there. You could potentially either be playing a turn behind for a while, or you could be taking a lot of damage from your own lands. The deck also leans very, very, very heavily on Sphinx's Revelation to draw cards. I think one of the more underrated losses from Esper from last block was Think Twice. You know, it gave you a way to spend mana on your end step if your opponent didn't do anything. You know, five mana draw two cards doesn't feel like the most powerful thing on the planet, but being able to do it on demand, especially when you need to hit your land drops, when you want to hit land drops 1 through 6, to be able to cast that Sphinx's Revelation into 3, to be able to draw more Sphinxes, and, you know, eventually just tie up a game like that. You know, you're really leaning on your Azorius Charms right now to be able to, you know, cycle them, hit your land drops. You get gutted on, you get stalled on 4 lands, and you can't cast your big spells. You know, Sphinx's Revelation for 1 doesn't feel good at all. It feels pretty freaking bad.
I feel like Azorius Charm is slightly weaker in the current meta than it was during Ravnica. There's a lot less haste and a lot less blitz coming at your face, and it feels like much less of a tempo gain than it was a year ago.
Well, there's still those pesky gods, and I think right now what Detention Sphere that very few cards in the format can do right now is they get rid of gods. And I think that's what makes Detention Sphere very attractive.
Cards like Azorius Charm, Detention Sphere that can sort of, you know, deal with it without trying to kill it, which is obviously impossible.
Certainly. You know, I think a lot of these Esper lists, you see them, they'll be packing Divination as a way to draw cards, because again, you don't have Think Twice as a way to draw cards on demand. You've still got your premier, you know, planeswalkers with things like, you know, Jace, Architect of Thought. You've got your Elspeth, Sun's Champion. And you've still got, you know, your finisher de jour, Aetherling. But, you know, the problem with any control deck is sometimes you don't draw the right cards, and hey, you're toast. You know, you can lean. My plan against the Esper decks playing mono blue was to find, if you're going to one for one my creatures, that's fine. The only thing I really cared about countering of theirs was the Sphinx's Revelation, because at some point, these decks are just going to start drawing last land. They have to pack anywhere from 26, you know, 26, I mean, I think less than 26 is a mistake, lands in any sort of these control decks, because you need to be able to reliably hit your land drops to cast your bombs. And my plan against the any sort of control deck was to say, fine, if you want a one-for-one deal with your removal spells, no problem. I mean, I'm not going to cast more than one or two creatures at a time, so if you're going to Supreme Verdict, you're not getting too much of a card advantage against me. And then my plan was just to counter the Sphinx's Revelations, have the Gainsay or have the Negate, whatever, Dispel, because without Sphinx's Revelation, they can't get back ahead. They can't, or catch up in a lot of places, because they take so much damage from their own lands or early creature rushes. They lean real heavily on Sphinx's Revelation. A lot of the older lists, especially from Ravnica block control decks, would run maybe three Sphinx's Revelations. A lot of these decks right now are running four, because they need to draw it. Even if they're casting it for two, you know, it gives them a chance to draw more of them. So it buys you time, it draws you cards, and, you know, hopefully draws you answers. And that's the reason to play Esper right now.
What are your thoughts on Ashiok, the Planeswalker? We saw a lot of lists early in the beginning that were trying to pack three of her in the deck, two of her in the deck. She's still running around $25. People were really, really keen on her. They still seem to be really keen on her, but she, to me, she's not around. She's not, or he, whatever. It's half a face. It's not a person. It's half a face. It's frightening as heck. Ashiok is nowhere to be found in the meta. Why is this still so pricey? You know, what are your thoughts on it in the deck?
Against a mid-range deck, it presents itself a very, very huge threat. You mill away one of their fags. Not only are you removing their ability to cast that creature, but, you know, when these mid-range decks are very light on threats as it is, it gives you the ability of unanswered to take it and beat their face in with it. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people just want it to be Nephalia Drownyard, which it isn't. But even against in the aggro matchup, the ability to boost itself to 5 loyalty is really good. But we're not seeing the mono red decks have kind of all been hated out. The card that was very good against. I don't know. I mean, it depends with Ashiok. Again, the metagame the metagame would evolve on, you know, between large tournaments. With the SCG series right now, it evolves every week. I mean, what's the deck of the week? What won the SCG Open, you know?
Well, it still seems like Theros only this week has finally kind of gotten its legs underneath it. Like Pro Tour Theros kind of woke everybody up.
To the power of devotion.
And now this week, you know, the SCG tournament this week, this is the weekend of the 19th and the 20th when we're recording this. So the SCG tournament in Seattle, the Grand Prix Louisville. See, these are the tournaments that are confirming what we may have thought. Yeah, this deck has staying power. This deck is staying power. Here are some more experimentation that people are doing. The experimentation didn't make it past these things that have already proven themselves in the Pro Tour. We did get a nice little cross section in the top eight, at least with the Grand Prix, but the big decks were kind of what we saw in the Pro Tour. Mono blue, mono black, green red, monstery ramp nonsense, and some Esper control.
I mean, just to finish off on Ashiok, I personally don't like the card as a finisher. I think any sort of Esper deck has more powerful things to be doing than casting Ashiok. I mean,
but is it a finisher? Liliana of the Veil was not a finisher, but she was still a very powerful early play.
My problem with Ashiok stems from the fact that, if you know, sometimes it's you cast it on three and you plus one her and you get nothing. So you've wasted, you know, she can be a distraction. I mean, one of the things that are valuable about Planeswalkers are they essentially add life points because of unanswered. Planeswalkers are scary. That's the nature of a Planeswalker, is that on an open board where the Planeswalker is the only thing there, they're terrifying. Because they sit there unopposed, and they, you know, they keep
and they
doing
do something every turn.
Yeah, I mean, with all the heroes' downfalls running around right now, I don't like Ashiok, because there are more powerful things you can be casting than Ashiok, yeah. In a lot of these decks. I mean, she made a huge splash right away, but I mean, given, I mean, she's a three mana planeswalker that goes right to five loyalty. That is in and of itself something inherently valuable. But I think in the long term, we'll see. That's kind of like I said, with the metagame, it depends on what people are playing.
Okay, so Ashiok maybe not so much, but we're seeing this deck doing well in the hands of really experienced control players. These guys who exclusively play control are still finding a way to deal with this deck. So you're at your local FNM, you got that guy who's been playing control his entire life, he's nothing but a blue mage, you're sitting down across Esper control. I'm surprisingly less afraid of this deck than I am against past control, even in the past year, control decks, or even like, you know, Esper Super Friends back during Scars of Mirrodin. What am I doing against this deck that's going to help me win? I mean, Supreme Verdict is still a card that still messes you up. What can we do?
The thing with playing a control deck is not something I'd casually pick up ever, because a control deck, the style of the control deck, it rewards you for playing well and it punishes you very, 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 very hard for making bad decisions. You've got a limited amount of threats. You've got a limited amount of resources, and it's about using your resources efficiently. You're really
hitting that pivotal moment of stabilization. You're waiting for that moment where you can viscerally feel that tempo swing.
Certainly. I mean, sometimes, you know, do I burn my hero's downfall right here to kill that card, or do I take a little extra damage to wait to catch him later with the Supreme Verdict? Do I, you know, go for it right now, even though it'll leave me in a vulnerable position, because I feel like, you know, if I don't go, I got to win now.
Right.
So the thing with any control deck, like I keep on coming back to Sphinx's Revelation, it's just that powerful of a card. These Esper decks are leaning very, very heavily on Sphinx's Revelation to catch them at, because as long as you don't walk into that sweeper, you don't get 4-for-1, 3-for-1 by a Supreme Verdict, well, eventually they're going to burn all their spot removal, or they're going to just start drawing lands, and you know, you're going to be sitting there with that 1-2-1, with that 2-2, just pecking away until they get to the Sphinx's Revelation. So with that counter, if you're playing blue, you have access to Gainsay, counter it. If you're playing black and red, you've got Slaughter Gains. Get it out of their hand. Get it out of the deck. The more I look at these decks, like, they're very, very, very streamlined. The removal package is real tight. They've got answers to all the powerful threats in the format, but they've got to draw them. And that's always the thing with these control decks. They have to have so many lands to be able to cast the big spells. And if they don't draw the spells, then you get through it. Mutavault is always a great answer to a control deck. It dodges all their sorcery speed removal. I went through a couple counter fights last weekend just trying to protect my Mutavaults, because I know they've, you know, short of having the Doomblade or the Hero's Downfall active, they're not getting it off the board. And you can sit there and just keep poking them at them with the thing, because, you know, the strategy I always feel like to beat any sort of control decks, you know, get in your early damage. You have to force them into a position where they have to, you know, put themselves at risk to be able to catch up to you, to be able to win. Like, if they're forced to leave themselves home, if they're not sitting there with six cards in hand and, you know, at 10 life, you're in a good position. If they're down, you know, 8-9 life, they're down to 2 or 3 cards and they're living off the top of their deck, you're in a good spot, especially, you know, just keep applying pressure. The trick to beating any control deck is you got to judge the situation. Do they have the sweeper? Can you afford to lose 2 to 3 cards? I played a matchup today where I was like, okay, if he's got the sweeper, he's got it, but I'm still holding more threats behind me. I've got the ability to draw cards. I've got Read the Bones. I've got Underworld Connections, where I'm like, okay, if he gets me on a 2-for-1 here, I've got the ability to keep drawing cards. Disruption, again, if you take things like Thoughtseize or even Duress, I think that's one of the reasons to play Mono Black right now. You can go post-board against any sort of control deck. You can have up to 4 Thoughtseizes and 4 Duresses, not to mention Sin Collectors if you're playing black and white. So, you know, the deck leans very heavily on specific cards to execute their strategy. And if you cut, and with a control deck, you've only got so many copies of them. You take away the copies and, you know, you'll eventually get through.
Brilliant. So these seem to be kind of the big guys standing out at the moment. Hopefully with some more experimentation, we'll see some more. I saw a Mono Black aggro deck today, which seemed like there might be something to that. If blue can get away with playing the creatures it's playing with, I feel like black can do the same. You know, Mogus Marauder seems like a really, really neat card in that deck to kind of just slap down some guys, make them all unblockable, get a lot of damage through. Maybe not quite so good if black continues to be a heavy card in the meta.
Well, again, with Theros, I feel like the cards in Theros, or the metagame in Theros, if you will, is really pushing synergy overpowering a lot of aspects. I mean, that card, like, I mean, pack, if you played Pack Rat last standard, people would just kind of look at you like you were weird.
Yeah, now, like you didn't really know what you were doing.
Exactly. And, but I said, or even, you know, Cloud from Raptor saw a little play, but something like, even like Judge's Familiar, I mean, it's a card I probably wouldn't have been caught dead playing main deck during standard last season. Right now, it's one of my favorite creatures in mono blue. You can, if, you know, a lot of your opponents are guilty of not reading the cards or just not paying attention to what's on the board state. Your opponent taps out to Rakdos Return, you, or they, you know, they've got just that, they get greedy and want to draw all the cards they can with the Sphinx's Revelation. Oh, that's a shame.
Well, it also works kind of like a mini Thalia. Like people, you know, even the people who are paying attention, it will set them a turn back more than they want to cast the spell that they want to cast the spell because they want to make sure they get it off.
Or for people who've been playing who remember Force Spike, you know, that one little mana. Hey, I had somebody walk into, I was playing against a black deck with Heroes Downfall. They tapped out to cast the Heroes Downfall to kill my Night Vale Spectre, but sacrifice the Judge's Familiar and counter it. And that enabled me to keep my Thassa on and keep beating. You know, little things like that. The power level of these cards, not as powerful as last, you know, obviously as Innistrad standard or even Ravnica standard. So we're leaning on other abilities to generate value out of our cards. In this case, I mean, the most popular card right now being Nykthos, generate your huge mana, generate your devotion with Grey Merchant. So where I think this format is headed is towards more synergy cards that, you know, not just, you know, a collection of powerful cards, but cards interact well with other cards in your deck. And I kind of like that.
And as always, you know, we encourage you guys to experiment because there's still a lot of hidden gems out there, we feel like. Reaper of the Wilds, to me, is a card that has not had its true potential tapped yet. There was a green-black sort of mid-rangey control-y deck that was doing kind of fairly well here at Grand Prix Louisville.
Well, there was Willie Adel played a Golgari deck at the Pro Tour, and just, you know, your classic green-black rock-style deck.
Right.
Efficient creatures, removal, disruption. I kind of think that Reaper of the Winds of Wild isn't going to see it stay in the sun as long as Desecration Demon is still in the format, because, you know, a 6/6 flyer is bigger than a 4/5 on the ground.
Sure, but I don't see any reason why you can't play both.
Certainly.
It just seems, you know, a 4/5 seems to be in really good position right now, and it is much, much harder to disrupt than Desecration Demon is. Like, I have seen lists experimenting around and playing, you know, 3/3 and trying to see how the function is there, so.
One of the things that I think is really awesome about the Reaper is that he dodges a lot of the removal in the form run. He's got 5 toughness, so he avoids Mizzium Mortars. He's got 4 power, so he avoids Selesnya Charm. He's black, so he avoids Doomblade. He's got, you know, a neat ability.
Hexproof, he has the potential to trade up.
Yeah, I mean, the Scry thing is, you know, not, again, not something to sneeze at. Scry 1, over time, it adds up. Again, I still think he's waiting to see his day in the sun, but I think it's a good card.
There's a lot of forgotten cards out there, and as we've always said, at least me, you know, I remember a lot more cards than most people do, and a lot of times you just play a single one of or something that just completely shakes up the strategy in a way that people aren't, you know, remembering. Like, you're generating a buttload of mana, play Clan Defiance and just throw it right at their face. You know, maybe play a single copy of Borborygmos for the mirror match and watch your opponent go, oh my god, what am I going to do against that card? I can't remember that was a thing. Like, try mixing it up a little bit, playing a copy here, a copy there, and you'll be surprised as to how much leniency that gets you if you hit a magic note.
Definitely.
All right, last thing I want to talk about before we end up this week is, you know, two decks that came out the gate the fastest. Mono Red won the first big tournament of Theros. It seemed to be a very obvious structure. Was probably the easiest deck to piece together right at the release of the set because Definitely. It didn't, you know, you just, a lot of really easy to get red cards. A lot of people already had the cards for like Gruul Aggro and this and the other thing. The other deck that, in my opinion, was the better deck coming right out the gate that I played in the beginning was the Selesnya aggro deck. I mean, you just got all these really, really high quality green-white cards. What's the state of these decks? Are they, you know, how much staying power do they have? Mono Red Devotion did top 8 in the Pro Tour.
But that was more of a mid-range build than an aggro deck. That Mono Red deck that was allegedly an early version.
Well, talk to me about it, because we, you know, VJ had very poignantly noted that, like, Mono Red has to change its face. It can't play Mono Red Blitz because we don't have Hell Rider anymore. We don't have a lot of the haste that we used to have in that deck. Well, and we don't have the growth that that deck was able to generate, so Mono Red has to change its face. Does it still have staying power in the format?
I think the problem with Mono Red with small creatures right now is that it takes a backseat to Mono Blue aggro, the Mono Blue Devotion deck. I think it's a strictly worse aggro deck than Mono Blue Devotion. It has absolutely no way of dealing with Master Waves. The Mono Red Devotion list that made the top 8 of Pro Tier Theros, you know, it's devoid of one drops. You've got a lot of high, it's meant to abuse Nykthos more. It's a Nykthos deck more than an aggro deck of any sort. If you ask me, I think Mono Red the aggro with, you know, two drops, kind of in trouble right now. It's not something that I'd want to play in any sort of even remotely competitive tournament. I don't think it has staying power right now. Even the versions that run Fnatic Amogus, there's too much spot removal in the format. There's a lot of life gain in the format, too, even with something as simple as Scavenging Ooze. He's still a guy. He's still around. And I think it's just inherently weak to the Selesnya aggro deck, which has, you know, whereas the Mono Red deck might be playing, you know, 2/2s for 2, the Green White deck is playing 3/3s for 2. Yeah.
And not only that, but, you know, before when we had Innistrad, I think what people are forgetting that Innistrad had a lot of really, really brilliant creatures, but they were all really small. It was a very relatively tiny set, especially coming after Scars of Mirrodin, where we had giant worms and Praetors and Karn and Titans right after that. Like, it was really, really big, and then we got to Innistrad, and it was all really, really tiny things in the realm of things. And now, you know, we're in Theros 2 years later, and everything's big again. And when everything is big, red tends to fall by the wayside. It just doesn't do enough. Spot burn just isn't enough, and that's the problem with red, is it's slamming into things that are bigger than it. It can't burn out things that are bigger than it, and it just doesn't have the ability to get through. And because it can't get through, it doesn't have the speed to get through before the defenses are set up anymore. So it is incredibly weak at this moment.
I mean, Mono Red just has too many bad matchups in the format. I mean, whenever I play against with Mono Blue, I almost feel, you know, it's really easy to beat that deck. You hide behind your Frostburn Weirds, your Omen Speakers. And, you know, you just wait to the point where you can resolve a Master Wave and say, hey, have a nice game.
Yeah. So what about Selesnya, though? The Selesnya aggro deck, it's still puttering around, it seems like. Where is its spot in the meta?
I really, really like Selesnya aggro, whether deservedly or not. You know, I like the version that won the second week. Was it the second SCG list? I think it's a very streamlined aggro deck. I think it comes out the gates as fast as any deck in the format. I think it's three, you know, the 3/3s, the Fleece Mane Lions, or whether they're and the Centaur guys.
Call of the Conclave, Fleece Mane Lion.
We'll give a lot of decks, you know, a lot of trouble because 3 power, you know, you get them out there.
Some people picked on it faster than others, but, you know, I was surprised how long it took for some people to go, why are we playing Dryad Militant when we've got Soldier of the Pantheon? That card is very well placed in the meta right now.
Definitely. I mean, it's a stone wall to Fleece Mane Lion. It's a stone wall to Voice of Resurgence.
It's a pain in the butt for the Mono Blue deck to deal with.
It goes through because it goes through Frostburn. It
goes through a lot of the things that the Mono Blue deck plays early to protect itself. It dodges a decent amount of things that Esper may want to do to it. And it's still a 2/1 for 1, you know what I mean? It still packs a lot of punch.
Best Savannah Lion ever.
It is really, really good. So, you know, again, where you like the deck, it has all these tools, why isn't it top 8ing?
You know, I think with the shift in the meta, I mean, I think you might see it come back just a little bit with things like Esper coming back again. I like having things like Group 1 defenses to fight off Supreme Verdict. Or even if, you know, they get through the Supreme Verdict, you flash in your Boon Satyrs, you flash in
Advent of the Worm.
Advent of the Worm. I really like the deck. I feel like it's very flexible. It gives you the, for an aggro deck, it gives you the ability to play, not only does it give you the ability to play on your opponent's turn, it gives you the ability to play effectively on your opponent's turn, which is very rare for an aggro deck.
I mean, it was a flash deck.
Yeah.
It's green-white flash. Like, it felt so weird to be piloting that deck because I was doing more things on the end step than I was on my first main phase.
I mean, I personally feel like of the aggro decks, you know, the green-white is the most equipped, the most resilient of the decks just because of the inherent tools they have. If you're against another aggro deck, you've got things like Unflinching Courage. If you're facing decks with, you know, sweepers, you've got Rootborn defenses. Again, I think people kind of have been shying away from it because of Mono Blue. It's got absolutely no way of dealing with flyers or without adding things like Plummet.
Well, it really can't disrupt the Mono Blue deck. And I did play a list where somebody was main decking Banisher Priest, and that seems to be the best tool against some of these decks. Like, again, especially against, say, like the Mono Blue or some of these decks where you're trying to, like, get rid of Desecration Demon or you know, catch things for a turn here or there.
They have Celestial Charm decks.
It seems to me to be a very reactive deck. It seems to be a deck that's like, hey, I'm going to drop these guys in the beginning, and then all I have to do is protect these early guys, much in the same way that the white-black deck works, where it's like, play something quick in the beginning and then control the board while I continuously peck you with these early guys, except the green-white guys are not pecking. They're punching pretty hard. But why is that strategy not working as well anymore? Is it because of all the black? Is it because of all the removal?
I personally don't know why the Selesnya aggro deck isn't having a little more success. In my testing with the deck, I mean, the deck has very high color requirements. There's a lot of gold cards in the deck.
You do kind of have to hit green and white on turn two.
And it really kind of, I mean, again, it comes back to not having the core set dual lands or even the Innistrad enemy duels, where when you're playing the aggro deck, and if you have to take a turn playing a tapped land, you know, you lose that one turn of aggression. It adds up over time. I personally think the deck is prone to running out of steam. You don't have a lot of card draw. And a lot of the times when you play the deck, you stall out. You know, they blunt your initial rush and they take control, you know, they go over the top of you. You know, whether it's a Thassa, whether it's something like Blood Baron or something like Aetherling, you know, you get to that point, they've got no answers to you. They don't.
I mean, green-white does have a history of board stall, but it seems, you know, this to me reminds me very much of just sort of a microcosm where M13, the core set of M13 seemed to, when you were drafting and when you were looking at the set, it seemed to call very heavily green-white, 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 and the smart players really started to picking up that says, look, even if green-white is your best option in the draft, force something else because it just will never deliver. And that seems to be what's going on right now. On paper, it's very, very fantastic. It's got all these ways to stop itself from being destroyed. And it has these very, very powerful creatures with vanilla test, you know, for their mana cost. And with things coming out of the sideboard like Brave the Elements, Rootborn Defenses, Ranger's Guile, Plummet to, you know, maybe stop the Desecration Demon. You've got, you know, Skylasher, Mistcutter, Hydra. It seems like it has all the tools, and yet for some reason, it just isn't there. It just, you know why? I think it's because, as you mentioned, the meta is very, very synergy focused right now. And the Selesnya deck is not a synergy deck. It is a thing where you have a bunch of cards that are individually very, very powerful. And that is proving to be not a safe strategy in the current meta.
I could have said it better myself.
All right, cool. So that's kind of going to wrap up what we're going to talk about here. Just a little couple of notes before we go. Two things, kind of a call out to the audience members. Number one, we've had a lot of people asking us about RSS feed. I thought that was something that was naturally taken care of by MTGcast. We found out recently when we were guest hosts with Chewy and Clues on Monday Night Magic that their RSS feed was not working very well. So I don't know if that's been repaired or if it ever worked in the first place for us. To be honest with you, I know a lot about editing and a lot about a great number of things, but I'm kind of clueless when it comes to the internet, and I don't know very much about RSS feeds at all. A lot of information I've tried to do to research and try and help me on it has not come up very helpful whatsoever. So if you are a listener out there, you're a fan of the show, and you think I know what I'm missing to kind of get, because we'd like to get, you know, we'd like to subscribe on YouTube, and we'd like to get ourselves up, because a lot of you guys have asked us to, like, hey, how come your podcast isn't automatically updating in, you know, my app that I have that just plugs in all of my podcasts when they get released. So we kind of need a little bit of help on that. So listeners, if you're like, yeah, I know RSS feed, please get a hold of us. You can always get a hold of us by email at midrangemagic@gmail.com, or hit me up on the Twitter at @turnemsideways, or hit VJ up on Twitter at @VJBangalore. Again, in the show notes, those are listed there. The other big thing that we wanted to talk about, we kind of hinted at this last week, but I think we need enough help that it's time to kind of let the cat out of the bag. VJ and I have been talking for about 2 weeks or so. With the kind of explosion that is Twitch TV and everything that is happening there, you know, we had said something up earlier in the year that we were really excited about, where we were going to be, you know, doing shows and doing, you know, tournaments and stuff on TV, and that all kind of fell through at no fault to ours. It's something that we really wanted to try and pick up again. And so we had been talking, and we very much want to try and turn Midrange Magic into a video program. We would do every week at night, kind of like a news program, we would do a live video podcast on Twitch TV where you guys would get to see us. It would be a lot more interactive because we'd have, you know, the interaction feed that goes on there. There'd be a lot more visuals going on. You guys could go back and watch those videos later. And then we'd simply take the audio recording of that segment and also release it as a podcast. So you guys could, you know, if you didn't get a chance to watch the show when you did and there wasn't any video feed, you could always listen to it later as a podcast if you're the type of person who's like, hey, I listened to the show on the work or whatever. So we would very much like to do this. I think we need a little bit of help in that sense too. We're just trying to, like, just some education on kind of like, any of you guys, if you stream or if you know streaming really, really well, and you can give us some insight on how to make that more smooth, because we'd really like to try and skip those first couple of times where it's just shaky and a mess in the beginning. That way we can just kind of jump in and it's ready to go and it's an awesome new experience. So again, email us at midrangemagic@gmail.com or hit us up on the Twitters and, you know, let us know your thoughts. Let us know if you got any suggestions to kind of help us out with that. We're kind of reaching out to you guys because the only other way that you can sort of get Magic as a visual broadcast at the moment, Evan Irwin has a great show he releases every once in a while called The Magic Show, which is about once a month. That's fantastic, but we don't think that that's consistent enough, and it kind of gives you information you already know. And the other thing is the SCG show that's part of their premiere package that's, you know, kind of an under-the-hood thing. And you know, again, we've expressed here, we don't feel like you should, you pay enough money playing Magic. We don't think a secondhand retailer has the right to charge you more money to experience more content. So, again, get a hold of us, let us know. I'd like to thank Wiley for being on the show again.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's always fantastic when you're on. Like I said, you're one of my very, very close friends, and you're very knowledgeable about the game from a critical level that, you know, our listeners really need to hear. This is that kind of stuff that it's very difficult for people to generate this information on their own, and they kind of need to be shown this. And it just kind of, like, I think you have the ability to sort of click with some people to make them just step up their game. And I'm glad you got a chance to do this and come on the show and we could talk about the meta, because this rotation has seemed to be a little harder to ease into than some in the past. Definitely. And congratulations on States.
Thank you.
Check out, pay attention to tcgplayer.com. Hopefully that article will be up relatively quickly in the next week or maybe 2 weeks, and you guys will get to read a much more concise breakdown about what his tournament experience was like, and it'll give you some insight on how to do this, because there's a lot, you know, we're about 2 or 3 weeks away from PTQs popping up all over. And there is a lot more tournaments this year than there was last year. Every weekend, you essentially have like two options of where you could be going to play. And that's not including, you know, a TCG player silver event over here, a Star City Games Open over here, a trial over here, a Grand Prix over here. You really can get your butt out and go play Magic whenever you want. So that breakdown should be a big help. Wiley, anything else you'd like to add before we close out?
Nope.
All right. I don't know what it is going to be at the time I'm recording this, but immediately after there is going to be a new song from VJ's band Common Shiner that we will put on the end of it. I haven't decided at this exact moment when I'm recording this right now when you're listening to my voice, so I will not decide till I actually get to editing, but the name of that song will be in the show notes. Again, check out his band. They're picking up a lot of steam. I hope you guys are enjoying the music so far, and as always, please be wonderful to each other.
On his bedroom floor, and I'm stuck reading about my faith through every